technology.ie. It's Friday, February 6th, 2015.
Technology.ie is brought to you by Ireland's premier hosting and domain registration company, Black Knight. Black Knight offer a comprehensive range of hosting and domain solutions for businesses of all shapes and sizes, no matter where they are in the world.
This is Conor Mwinachon in the Black Knight studio. I'm on Skype with Malachy Brown. Hello, Malachy.
How are you, Con?
Welcome to the show. Malachy, you are the managing editor and Europe anchor for a new news organisation, which is called Reportedly, which is part of a new media group called First Look Media. Tell me a bit about that, Malachy, first of all.
Yeah, First Look came about around a year ago. The first newsroom that that was set up was called the Intercept, and that is a newsroom that specialises in state surveillance, primarily US focused, and issues of national security that are related to that. And it was founded by Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras, and Jeremy Scahill, and with the financial support of Pierre Omidyar, who is a philanthropist, and he's also probably best known for setting up eBay and doing quite well out of that, and then investing a lot of money and time into various different philanthropic endeavors. And First Look Media is the first foray into media, and it's a not-for-profit organization that he set up, as I say, about a year ago with these founding editors. Reportedly is the latest newsroom created in First Look Media, and we're really the social journalism arm of First Look. And so we're two distinct newsrooms, and we're very much sort of real-time engaging people on social media around international stories and that sort of thing.
I'm going to ask you more about Reportedly's work in detail and First Look Media in general, Malachy, but tell us a bit about yourself, first of all. It's an international organisation, but you have a very Irish-sounding voice. You were involved with Storyful, you were involved with Village Magazine as well, and you have a background in technology. Give us a bit of a fill-in there on the background of Malachy Brown.
Suppose I came out of college in 97, having done engineering and electronic engineering, and of course computer programming was part of that. And that was that time there was a tech boom. It was the pre Y2K years, and of course a lot of organizations were dreading what was going to happen when the clock passed midnight on Y2K. And so there was a huge tech boom around that time. And I started working in that as a computer programmer, and worked at that for several years until eventually I thought it was time to move on and try different things. And I did a master's down in Limerick in international studies, and then started working for Village Magazine, which is run by Vincent Brown, who's an uncle of mine. So fair play to him. He gave me a break. So in Village then I worked in setting up a website, started reporting as well, kind of got into, I suppose, the tech side of it, production, doing the production side of it as well. So I've got very much immersed into the tech side of media, I guess, through that. And then thereafter, I set up, again, with Vincent Politico, and used a lot of free online tools, publishing tools, to create a magazine archive and to do kind of little projects like TD Watch was one of them, where we drew information from lots of different disparate sources together into a single page where you could find out lots of information about your TD, be it salary, expenses, declarations of interest, you know, their social profiles and so forth. And then moved on from there to Storyful, which is very much technology-driven journalism again.
It's taken, when you talk about Politico and I suppose pulling together publicly available information and correlating items from different sources, and then the work that Storyful got involved with verifying stories which and content which originates in social media from citizen journalists and things like that. It's very much the case, really, isn't it, that technology has laid out a whole array of tools for media and for journalism to work. In theory, at least, Malachy, we should be getting better journalism than ever before, shouldn't we, with the kind of technology that's available to journalists now?
We should, yeah. I mean, not just, technology really has made so much more information available as a starting point, you know, hardware and connectivity and the affordability of that for a lot of people. And also, you know, not just on social media, speaking from with a Storyful hat on or a reportedly hat on, you know, there's so much electronic info on electronic information that describes our society, the public bodies, charities, other groups that you might want to investigate, business, and so forth. And also technology is available to make that discoverable, to crunch the data. And there's, you know, an array of publishing tools and mediums and so forth available to us now as journalists to kind of do really neat infographics and make sense of all of the data. And you're right, you would expect that we would have better journalism than before. There's that cliche that we're now in the golden age of journalism. And I suppose we have the potential to be, definitely, but I think a lot of news organizations haven't yet bridged that gap where data journalism and information-driven journalism is a core part of what they're doing. There's some that are better than others, but you know, it's not a universally adopted approach yet.
Yeah, I've asked this question before, especially to media people on the show. I've asked Pat O'Mahony and people like that are involved in media in Ireland. But I'll ask you what your take is on it, seeing as we're talking about it, Malachy. Yeah, we are in a golden age of journalism in terms of the tools and technologies that are available. But what's going to pay for it? People aren't going to buy newspapers. People are used to getting content for free online. And what's your reaction or response to the often heard criticism that we're in a new age of lowest common denominator clickbaiting type of journalism, and that serious investigative work is not going to be funded and paid for?
Yeah, we're certainly seeing that happen. You know, media is more about business than it is about the journalism, unfortunately, at the moment. And you see that dilution of quality happening. And you know, some organizations, just like BuzzFeed, build their reputation on that, and branded content. We're seeing more and more branded content becoming part of the staple of journalism. And branded content is effectively, you know, advertorial dressed up as a news story, to the best possible extent, you know, for the advertisers. And The Guardian, interestingly, today The Guardian said that there's going to be a lot more branded content on their website in 2015. Gavin Sheridan, who I worked with, is a visionary in terms of media information and where they sit. And he wrote a very good blog post on Medium recently, about 3 months ago, perhaps, about how the opportunity is there for newsrooms to build information discovery and analysis as part of their journalism, but also, you know, to build a bespoke business out of that, where you can resell that information to interested parties. And I think that's a really interesting approach to take, that there is so much information out there that you could perhaps, you know, he's actually after starting up a new company that's looking at this for legal information, and he plans to make a business out of that. But there's no reason why, you know, a legal journal couldn't do that, and have access to tremendous information and have great insight and analysis into various different legal cases and practices that are happening, while also having a separate business that would sell that information. That's all public information, on in a meaningful way.
It really is evolving very, very fast indeed. And I think people are exploring all kinds of opportunities at the moment. Let's talk about, I suppose, one response to the current environment for media and journalism, which is reportedly. Tell me how you went from Storyful to reportedly. And in particular, what is it that made you choose the job and what kind of a job is it?
Andy Carvin is the editor of Reportedly, and he was brought on to into First Look Media, having spent 11 years at NPR, which is National Public Radio in the States. And anybody who knows Andy, Andy's work will be familiar with what he did during the Arab Spring, very much being the sort of, as he says, the real-time disc jockey online, bringing people sources together around events that were happening in the Arab Spring. And that's where he cut his cloth in terms of social media reporting and journalism. And he had this idea that could be replicated, you know, across time zones, across continents, writ large, with the right team of people. And there's a social media journalism group on Facebook, and I saw him just posting about that he had this idea. And so I responded to him and said that was something that I was interested in, and it just, you know, it led from there. In December I left Storyful 1 week and joined First Look Media. We had our meeting just before Christmas there in the States. Second week.
Was a physical get-together meeting, Malachy, but that's not how you guys work day-to-day and week-to-week.
No, we're distributed. We have a journalist in Greece, Italy, me here, and then Andy in DC, two journalists in LA, and then we've got a couple of freelancers and, of course, the First Look Media headquarters in New York. And then there's a product team, tech team, if you like, available to us in San Francisco as well. So we're spread across several time zones. We're covering 18 hours a day. It's a small team initially.
I guess you'd probably worked like that before anyway, Malachy, being in the technology
industry. At Storyful was 24/7. And so there was a team in Hong Kong, a few in Europe, the headquarters here in Dublin, and the team in the States. So I was very, very much used to that. And again, technology allows you to create a virtual newsroom, really. Mm-hmm. And that's how we work. You know, we've got instant messenger chats and we've got Google Hangouts rolling. So, you know, we're all available to each other at a moment's notice. You know, it's just like sitting beside somebody else. You know, we're ever present. So all of the tools that we need, we can share. You know, with a little bit of preparation, you know, we essentially created a workstation that's entirely online, and we all have the same tools available to us. We've kind of standardized the operation in as much as possible across the various different time zones.
It's a challenge as well, I can imagine, because and what prompted us, I think, to have this conversation was before Christmas, I published a podcast that we had done with Tommy Collison, who's studying journalism at the moment in NYU. And Tommy, in his spare time, has become interested in, I suppose, the whole issue of encryption and privacy tools, in particular for people working in media, but for anyone really. And the recommendation by Edward Snowden that encryption works and we should use it. This is obviously something that's of interest to yourselves as well. And I think when you and I were discussing having this chat, first of all, you mentioned an article. I'm not sure who it was written by, but it was in relation to getting Edward Snowden and Glenn Greenwald in touch with each other using privacy tools, and basically bringing the two of them up to speed to make sure that they could communicate securely. There's a little bit of a threshold there. There's a little bit of a barrier to entry and a learning curve when it comes to using privacy. But it's vital, wouldn't you agree, in the kind of work that you're doing?
Absolutely, particularly given the revelations of the NSA files, and also having heard what Jeremy Scahill went through. I'd recommend anybody look at his documentary Dirty Wars, when he was investigating US drone strikes in Yemen, and essentially he got a phone call from somebody in the administration who was anonymous, who's saying that you're skating on thin ice. And he realized that half of his hard drive had been hacked, and people had access, had taken a lot of his files and his information. But there's an interesting backstory there. Snowden emailed Glenn Greenwald and said, "I have something that might be of interest to you. Can you install encrypted email?" And Greenwald, of course, gets lots of these approaches, did nothing about it, got a second email, did nothing about it again. Yeah. And then he approached Micah Lee, who was with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and said, "Can you get Laura Poitras to set up, I think it was Jabber OTR, which is another secure platform?" And anyway, to make long story short, they managed to get in touch and communicate securely, and led to the revelations. And so security is, a very important part of our setup in First Look. That first induction week, we had briefings by legal and by media and PR people and the research team, but a large chunk of it was the security team. And before we even got to that point, we had instructions set up as to how we encrypt our emails and encrypt drives and all of that sort of thing, and the types of messengers and how we communicate, types of platforms that we should use. So it's taken very seriously at First Look Media.
Let's talk about the work you're doing at Reportedly, part of First Look Media, Malachy. What is your mission? What are you about? What kind of reporting do you do, and how do you reach your audience?
Well, we're the social journalism arm, really. So really what we're trying to do is find people who are telling, important, compelling stories that are of international and even local importance, to engage with those people and to engage with others who are experts on particular topics, to do that and deliver it onto the networks that people are organically engaged in. So Twitter, Facebook, Reddit, for probably more live experiences. And then, to document what we're doing in sort of digests or your traditional stories. And we're using Storify and Medium to do that at the moment. So we're using lightweight tools. We're conscious that we want the bulk of our work to be on those platforms. And if we're to develop any website or mobile presence, that, it very seamlessly integrates what we're doing ourselves anyway into that destination, if you like, be it a mobile app or a website. So that's really it. We also, I suppose, want to kind of add value back into the conversations. So, we've got a team of fairly accomplished social journalists, and we know how to navigate the social web, how to add value to various stories, how to verify information, for instance. A large part of what we want to do is to be transparent about the reporting process, as well as being transparent about what we know and what we don't know about various different stories.
Just to pick up on one point you mentioned there, you don't actually have a website yet. It's more important to you to build a presence on the various social media platforms and say, this is our content, take it away.
That's it. We want to build an audience. We want to build a community, I suppose, really. And we're seeing that engagement happen already around different stories. We were less than, 48 hours in operation when the Charlie Hebdo attacks happened. And that was a baptism by fire for us. But we very quickly had a community of French speakers and people who were there following us, adding value into the conversation, steering us in different directions. I remember when there was one suspect wrongly named who had been in school in that particular day, and his schoolmates just were over the top on social media in his defense. I think a lot of people kind of glossed that over, but teenagers are over the top on social media, and so we were able to talk to them and engage with them and get a lot more insight into that particular element of the story.
So as you describe it, it really is a two-way conversation. You're using social media as your publishing platform, but in doing so, it's also your sources. It's also you're publishing stories to an audience, about that audience in certain cases, and they're engaging with you and helping you improve the story.
Correct. And you know, if somebody's uncomfortable engaging in public, of course, we take that conversation offline. And, you know, it's traditional journalism. It's just, you know, a different way of communicating around it.
Which platforms do you find more productive or more engaging in that way?
I suppose most of our work is done through Twitter. Again, particularly the real-time work. Storify then, depending on the stories, we find that the stories that really represent a conversation or a community, I don't like using the word movement because I think people don't really think of themselves as being part of movements. They think of themselves as being part of communities. That those ones that are kind of focus in on a particular story or element or strand of a broader story are the ones that resonate with people, and also the ones that are visually compelling as well.
Is Reportedly a non-profit, and if not, how is it planned to sustain itself?
It's a not-for-profit, but that doesn't mean that we're far loss,
yes.
If you like. So we do need to eventually come to a way for it to sustain itself, and we will be looking to partnerships with other news organizations, people who are engaged in a similar space to us. But that's quite a while away. So for the first year, you know, we're really in an experimental phase. We're being given that latitude, which is great. You know, we're essentially a startup without any of the hangups of having to build a product and sell something. Which is, you know, it's a privileged area to be in, or privileged position to be in. And so we're going to keep experimenting and see what works and take feedback from the community itself.
It's very early days for you, of course, Malachy, but what has struck you so far in this work, or what has perhaps surprised you, or what is the most interesting aspect of it now that you're up and running?
We're very consciously not breaking news. While we're responding to real-time news, I see now, having stepped away from an organization that did, I suppose, specialize in breaking news, that there are a lot of people doing it and people doing it very well in some ways. So I see that there's that gap in terms of information bubbling out has definitely narrowed. And again, what's interesting to me is the types of stories that resonate with people, and they're very much the ones that represent the underdog, if you like. Yeah. And that's really what social media does. You know, it provides a voice to anybody. Anybody can be a producer of content, a broadcaster now, essentially. We have the means to do that. You know, that. I suppose that's where we come in, trying to spot those voices, those authentic eyewitnesses, and bring those up through the cracks, you know.
Well, it sounds fascinating, Malachy, and we wish you every success with it. Thanks for talking to us on technology.ie.
Cheers, Colin.